Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we take a look at the world of insects here in Wisconsin. They're around even in the wintertime. Phil Pelletieri, our guest, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at the University of Wisconsin, retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and he comes by every couple of months and we talk bugs with him. And maybe you have some bugs bugging you. I hope you'll join in with your questions or comments. Maybe it's something that's a bother. Maybe it's just a question about insects that you have. Join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post your insect photo and question on our Facebook page. The Larry Mueller Show is the place to go for that. Phil Pelletieri, welcome back.
Nice to be here.
So I had an ant run across my floor with a cat hot in pursuit.
This is not good.
Just the other day. And I'm wondering, what the heck is going on here?
Well, the first thing is you can almost be assured that it is not a native ant. I mean, all our native ants pretty much go into a hibernating-like state. I mean, that's just the natural, you know, climate they've evolved in. And so typically when we see ant activity at this time of the year, it is an invasive ant, European, tropical, whatever. And then the other thing with the temperatures that we have now, you know they have to be nesting warm, which means inside the house.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's not a good sign to see ants from maybe the middle of November till, oh, even middle of April. I mean, that usually suggests one of two things, that they're nesting inside. And some of our native ants, like carpenter ants, once in a while you'll see some activity in February or so when they're nesting indoors.
This one looked like a carpenter ant.
Okay. It could be, but typically, again, they go dormant. They kind of shut everything down. Mm-hmm. And then what I'm used to seeing is maybe early January, the calls would come in, and you just see an occasional ant. They weren't looking for food. They're looking for water, and they're trying to get the humidity up in the nest. And then as the weather progresses, but as I said, you can draw a line in the sand. It is just too cold for outside ants to be active until at least the middle of April, if not later. So now, you could have brought it in on, you know, if you're burning wood, there's a way you bring them in and kind of wake them up because of the warm temperature. But as I said, typically our native ants are just, no matter where they're located, are going to lay low for about a month or two, whereas ones that are active all winter, like pavement ant, became really the dominant ant complaint I got towards the end of my career. And that was an ant that I rarely saw when I first started. That's a European species that has kind of moved into the state.
What about my Christmas tree? What did it have? Come in. Well, I've had that Christmas tree up since the day after Thanksgiving. So
most Christmas trees are not big enough to sustain an ant nest in the trunk, and that's what it would take for field ants and the like. You know, once in a while we get aphids and a few other minor things that kind of wake up from a tree. I remember years ago there used to be a very incorrect urban legend that deer ticks would come in on Christmas trees, and we never saw any evidence of that. But as I said, I have seen some cases where there are aphids in the warm weather wake them up. So you see these little gnat-like things kind of flying around. But that's about it. I would not, as I said, the kind of trees you expect a carpenter ant nest would be way too big to be your Christmas tree.
Julie in Wales has a question for you, so let's go there. Julie, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, happy holidays, guys.
To you as well.
I have a horrible problem with what I call them stink bugs. You squash them, and they give off a very odd smell. I'm not sure if there's, like, a colony in my house, but it seems like every time I flush one down the toilet, three appear. They're like magic stink bugs.
Okay. Are they,
so I don't know what to do, how to get rid of
them. Are they kind of long and skinny, or are they more kind of small and shield-shaped?
They look like little tanks. They look like they have a hard shell on them.
Okay, then
they don't fly particularly well either.
Yeah, up until about 4 or 5 years ago, I would be sure that this is probably a western conifer seed bug, which has an odor to it. But the other thing that has changed in the last 4 or 5 years is this Asian stink bug that we call the brown marmorated stink bug have moved in. And the story is the same with both of them in the sense that they aren't breeding indoors. Everything you see all winter long basically snuck in sometime during October or so. And so they're in the walls. And, you know, when things warm up, a couple of them wake up and come. So it's not as if I can give you any magic spray. I mean, the good news is it's really a nuisance. The one thing I think I would keep in mind in the future is, you know, you mentioned that there was mostly your east windows. That suggests to me there's a weakness there, you know, and there might be something you can caulk around the window frame or something else before next fall to prevent them from getting in. But, you know, now the frustration is, you know, fine when it is out in front of you. You could use a spray, probably even kill them with soapy water. But the ones in the wall you can't touch. And so it really isn't very effective to go with any sorts of sprays. And, you know, I find, you know, a vacuum cleaner or something similar is probably just as easy a way of dispatching them as anything else.
Okay. Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. They're not going to create big problems, just a sort of a nuisance.
Well, no, you know, I teased one of the reasons I retired when I did is, you know, the problems they had with this Asian stink bug out east were just almost science fiction level. And we haven't quite seen that, but we've definitely seen a buildup. And, you know, whether I've seen more around my house this year than I've ever seen before, talking to PJ at the lab, you know, he's getting... It's kind of a slow increase, which we are very thankful for.
Right.
But I would not be surprised that, you know, this will continue to be a growing problem for a few years.
Let's go to John in Green Bay next. John, hi.
Good morning. Happy holidays.
To you as well.
A problem I have an outdoor cat. Cat usually sleeps in my bed at night. And this problem coincides, I think, with the snow that we've gotten here in Green Bay. But yesterday I took my usual shower in the morning. About mid-morning, I'm starting to scratch around my belt, and I've got all these bites, you know, welts around my belt, probably a dozen or more. And
okay.
I'm just wondering what it could be.
My first guess really is probably cat fleas, although it's more traditional when you get cat fleas brought in the house. To get the bites around the ankle, but if your cat sleeps in the bed, I can see where it goes on. And the weird thing about it, dermatologists tease about breakfast, lunch, and dinner bites, but, you know, cat fleas don't like the way we taste, so you often get clusters of bites. They keep on trying to bite, and they don't like the taste, and they back out and move. There is one other problem we get with cats. There is a mite, what we call a fur mite, that doesn't cause bites on the cat, but causes a dandruff-like skin condition. But that little stinker, if it bites you, you do get significant bites. Almost more blistery-like.
It's like mad.
That's classic of flea bites. That's more, you know, the thing about the fur mite is it tends to be more blistery, and it's more common, I see it, in the forearms of people because, you know, the cat's sitting in your lap and you're, you know, sitting and enjoying the cat, and that's where you get the contact. So, you know, I think it'd be worth checking the cat out. The tough thing, you know, it's most of the fleas we get in the house are cat fleas, and they either come from cats, dogs, raccoons, or possums. But even though it's the same flea, they're more difficult to control on cats, and it has to do with the flea life cycle. And you know, the adult fleas will, you know, be out in the like almost anywhere, but the only place fleas breed is where an animal rests, because there has to be an accumulation of processed blood. We call it flea dirt. And, you know, with the dog, it's often out in the open. With, you know, the raccoon, it's up in the chimney. But the cat, because of their behavior, they often get the breeding back in a closet or under a bed. And if you don't search out those hot spots, you don't get control. So people spray and bomb and do all these things. The things are resistant, and it's not really so much a resistance as not understanding that you really got to hunt down those special places where the cat likes to rest and groom and stuff. And that's often where you'll find the true breeding going on.
Hmm.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. If you, let's say it's laying there all the time on a special blanket, if you just wash the blanket?
It will help dramatically. Again, wherever you get this accumulation of flea dirt, if you can do something to deal with it. That's why we have trouble in carpets, because there's so much can filter down deep in the carpet, and you can't really vacuum that stuff out. You know, in the short run, you know, if you catch fleas very early, even vacuuming daily drastically reduces the population of adults. You know, some people will take the animal to the vet, or they can buy some things that will stop the flea breeding. But sometimes it takes a number of weeks to kind of settle down, might be a way of putting it.
John, thanks again. Mary in Waukesha, your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have a jade plant, and something, probably some little white insect, is making white fuzzy spots on the ends of the branches.
Mm-hmm.
And
how long have you had the plant?
Big and fuzzy.
Yeah, how long have you had the plant?
It's a pretty old plant, and it's been doing it all summer.
Okay.
And so I put it out in the hot sun to see if the hot sun would kill them, and it slowed them down. And then I brought it in, washed it off in the shower, and put it out, and it started up again. So then I tried spraying it with soapy water. Mm-hmm. How much soap can I put in the water?
Okay, well, a couple things. It sounds like mealybug, which is a tropical insect that gets kind of white and fuzzy. And one of the problems with mealybug is the adults and the eggs are not very susceptible to treatments. So I'm a big fan of soap, but you have to treat it at least 2 to 3 times, spaced about 2 weeks apart, to kind of overcome all the life stages. The other thing about soaps, and we've talked about this so often on the show, is that when you get stuff off the grocery store shelf, I'm not sure what's in there. Whereas the stuff that is sold as insecticidal soap has both the right formulation, and it doesn't have any plant-burning compounds like whiteners, brighteners, perfumes, or the like. Because what they're using is about a 1%, maybe sometimes 2% solution. If you use a stronger solution than that, it burns. So, again, what I'm fearful of, and jades are a little touchy, is that... If you go too strong, or you pick the wrong soap that's not one of these commercially available insecticidal soaps, you might burn the plant. One other thing you can do, though, if you really want to go that direction, treat the plant and then 10 minutes later, wash everything off. Soaps only kill on contact, so there's no reason to leave it there. And the longer you leave the residual, the more likely you are to get a phytotoxic response on the plant.
But otherwise, if you get an insecticidal soap...
Yeah, that shouldn't... Although, with a jade, jades and ferns are two that I get nervous about, just because they're kind of touchy plants. And as I said, so if this is a real important plant to you, treat it, wash it off, 15 minutes later, and then mark the calendar to come back in 2 weeks, and then I would do it a third time in that succession. So what happens sometimes is people treat, it looks like you got them, you wait 6 weeks, all of a sudden they're there again, and you never have enough treatments and a tight enough schedule to overcome, as I said, the factor that some of the life stages are hard to kill.
What temperature, say I put it outside when it's just below freezing for a while or something, what temperature outside do you think would kill them off?
The temperatures that would kill you, to take the jade. The plants are far more susceptible. Even though these are tropical insects, they can tolerate a moderate cold much more than the plant can.
Okay.
All right. There you go. Sounds like insecticidal soap.
Yeah, one other option, and if you realize its limitations, for real big plants that are hard to spray, there are little insecticidal spikes. They contain a systemic insecticide you can put in, and it will move through the plant. But the dilemma with that is that it does not move through the plant equally well. So it goes well into the new growth, not so good in the old growth, and so it never really cleans the population up. It holds them back. And then the other thing, if you've got pets and kids, people are not comfortable with putting insecticide in there. So, as I said, it is a potential treatment, but you got to realize its limitations also.
Thank you, Mary, for calling. Appreciate it. Phil Pelletieri, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at the UW-Madison. Great to have him along. Thank you for listening in. One open line at 800-642-1234. If you have a photo of an insect maybe you want identified, or just kind of a cool photo, I hope you'll post that up on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And Phil, speaking of Facebook, Sharon sent us a photo, pretty good, a relatively good close-up of a bug that she wonders if it's a bed bug. It's orange and...
Yeah, it definitely is a bed bug, but the one... thing I cannot tell from the picture is it the human bed bug, which has been so much of an issue the last 10 years or so. There is a bed bug associated with bats. There's a bed bug associated with chimney swifts. There's a bed bug associated with barn swallows. And you wish that it's one of the bird or bat ones, because they're much easier to control. But where you control them is different. Now, with this travel history, that would lean you towards the human bed bug. The problem we've had with human bed bugs is I can't send somebody to the hardware store to buy something that I have any faith in. They're resistant to most treatments, and it's a kind of problem that you should consult, I think, professional help, at least, chat. They use heat treatments. I mean, there's some ways to wrestle with it, but I think you need to be pretty aggressive. You don't want to let this thing fester. Yeah. You know, part of it is if you look on the internet, there's some pretty good stuff on help you inspect where they could be. It's usually around the mattress frame. Sometimes you even get in the box spring and remove the dust cover and look in the wooden frame to see if you can see where the bed bugs might be. You know, the heat treatment, you know, washing sheets and that kind of thing would easily kill. In fact, even putting things in the dryer. The trouble is these little stinkers get back in these cracks and crevices you can't get to very easily. So, as I said, it's definitely a bed bug. If you still have a specimen, it would be worth sending it into PJ just to see. If it's the bat critter, life is much easier because then, you know, a little bit of caulking around the light fixtures, and then when things warm up, you can either convince the bats to go elsewhere or maybe treat up there. And they are easily killed with insecticides. Whereas I said, the human bed bugs we tend to find is most of the things you can buy at the store, they have resistance built in, and so they will not be effective.
Let's go to Gene in Mount Horeb next. Hi, Gene. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. We built our house back in 1988, and ever since it was, even before it was dried in, up until the present day, we have these small brown moths. They're a quarter, well, they're a half inch or so to three quarters inch. Their profile, instead of being triangular, is oval, and they're very flat. I find them mostly in the bathroom, but I can find them anywhere. I'm wondering what those larvae are eating.
Okay, you know, with your description, I'm going to suggest that you look on the internet under something that we call a drain fly or a moth fly.
Okay.
Because it fits the pattern. When you talk about moths in the house over a long period of time, by far the most common ones are associated with foodstuffs, you know, pet food, and,
right,
you know, that kind of thing. The other one I get sometimes in some of the northern counties is there are moths that breed on the leaves of popple trees and birch trees, and then the adults come in the fall. And then, you know, so you have all these moths flying around, but that's kind of a seasonal thing. Because of the wet places you're located, moth flies have very fuzzy wings, so they look just like a moth. You crush them, there's all this powder-like stuff, and so that's really where the name is derived from. But they're maggots are associated with floor drains and other, you know, septic systems and, you know, places that are high moisture and usually have some organic matter. And, you know, sometimes as easy as getting a hot pail of water and flushing it down a drain is the solution if that's what it turns out to be. So it's kind of like, it, you know, knowing what it is targets what you got to have to go after. But that would be kind of more classic, more reoccurring kind of problem. And as I said, rather than being a plant-based or food-based critter, it's associated with water. And in fact, of anything, they're distant relatives of mosquitoes rather than anything that you normally
right.
expect.
Wow, that's really cool. Okay, well, I will look that up.
All right.
That makes sense. I often have to treat my floor drain with bleach because we'll get mosquito, you know, crop.
Okay, well, you know, in that one, honestly, I would suggest a real hot, and be careful, pail of water is more effective. Interesting enough, what you do bleach, all it does is it sterilizes the outside. And critters like this breed in the crud that tends to accumulate on the outside of the pipes or, you know, the inside of the pipes. The hot water is more likely to flush that. The other step, you know, that you can do is if it's a persistent problem and the hot water doesn't solve it, you can buy some of these enzymatic drain cleaners that will eat through that crud and get it out of there. Because as I said, that's the substrate that breeds these kind of things, not just the presence of water. And the problem with bleach is it doesn't penetrate. You know, if the crud's, you know, 5-6 millimeters thick, it only sterilizes the outer part of it, and that's it.
There we go. Good luck, Gene. Thank you.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Brian in Delafield, it's your turn. Hi, Brian.
Good morning.
Morning.
Last summer, I was washing my siding on my house next to a deck, and I was using a bleach and Simple Green solution and spraying it on with a garden hose sprayer. And then as I would go over the cobwebs, the spiders in those cobwebs would just kind of curl up and shrivel up. But the stuff was running down the siding into the area underneath the deck. And I'm telling you what, the biggest, blackest spider I've ever seen come crawling up out of there.
Mm-hmm.
The spray nozzle on the head of my wand is about 2.5 inches in width. I put it down next to the spider, and he exceeded the width of that nozzle head. I would say that the legs were probably 4.5 inches wide.
Sure.
Yeah.
Hairy as can be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And its palps were visibly large, shiny, and black. And I said, as soon as I saw that, I said, I got to call Phil and find out what this is. So do you have any idea? I've never seen a spider that big in Wisconsin.
Yeah, one of two things, and they're really closely related. There's a Dolomites fishing spider that we see, and it would have somewhat banding on the legs, you know, kind of light and dark banding. But also wolf,
black.
Yeah, wolf spiders. And then it's probably a wolf spider. And
yeah.
In both cases, they're nighttime hunting spiders. They really don't have a web. So they often hide in litter and then are active at night searching out their prey. And although they look scary as heck, you know, the general rule with spiders is the bigger and meaner they look, the less of an issue it is. So, you know, they're nothing dangerous. Now, could one bite you? Yes. Is it dangerous? No. Would I want to be bit by one? Probably not. But you can't, you know, as you know, spiders that big are very adept at getting away. It's not as if they're aggressive at you. So, as I said, it is definitely one of the wolf spiders, and we have them varying from almost cream color. Many of them are brown, but grays and blacks also fit. And as I said, there's nothing else in this state that can fit that size. We have some nursery web spiders, which you often see on milkweed and the like, and they're more of a two-tone spider. The big fishing spiders and the big wolf spiders. And as I said, without seeing the banding on the legs, that would lead me to a wolf spider.
So I can tell my wife she can go back on the deck now.
Yeah. And if you go online and type in wolf spider, you're going to get
a photo. There's lots of different kinds. I mean, there's small wolf spiders, you know, the size of a penny or less, but the real big ones. And as I said, you'll probably get some of those impressive ones because those are the ones that are fun to take pictures of. So.
It was impressive.
Thanks, Brian.
Okay, thank you.
Carolyn in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Appreciate your call.
Yeah, I'm calling in regard to the gentleman who called in with the itchy bites around his waist.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if it might be scabies and the cat is just a red herring.
That could be. Now, you know, it's interesting, you know, entomologists typically don't touch scabies because it's a medical problem. This is a mite that literally burrows into your skin and causes significant itching. Rather characteristically, it's often in damp areas of the body, so, you know, under the arms, in the groin area, but it could be elsewhere. And interesting enough, there are scabies associated with pets, too. And although the human scabies is host specific, I do know people who have had dogs who have had mange and whatnot that have had some skin irritations. But the problem with that, or not the problem, but if you need a diagnosis, you basically need to go see your family doctor and they do a skin scraping and look for the presence of the mites. And one of the things professionally used to bother me a little bit is, and I understand from the physician standpoint, but the people that would get treated for scabies without doing the skin scraping. And I think what the physicians were trying is, you know, we'll try this. If it cures it, fine. We not. If we'll take it the next step. But from my standpoint, I think a lot of people got convinced that they had this mite infestation, and it turned out they probably didn't. But it's worth checking. It would be one more on the checklist of when you're trying to pick up these mysterious bites. And, you know, and the other frustration I think we all have is that there are times things present like insect bites that are not. You know, and there again, you often have to see a physician, a dermatologist,
get that
such
figured out.
To try to figure out. But I'd start with the cat fleas. I was a little bites around the waist from cat fleas is not typical, as I had mentioned. It's more typical around the ankles for adults and stuff, and for, you know, crawling kids, sometimes it can be all, you know, on the face because they're right down there by the carpet. But I can't rule it out, especially because the cat was sleeping in the bed. But yeah, scabies definitely would be one that, you know, if they can't find fleas, you know, sometimes that's people take the pet to the vet, and the vet can tell pretty quick if they've got fleas. Or, as I said, this little fur mite, which is a little bit more insidious because you can't see it with a naked eye. The way we would look for it from the entomology side of things is we ask people to use a little piece of tape in those kind of dandruffy areas on the pet, and then we put the tape under a microscope, and we can see the mites. In fact, one of the kind of coin names for this that fur mite is walking dandruff, but that refers to the pet. So yeah, as I said, bites are tough. I think for all of us, because we're often walking into it after the fact, and usually you kind of ask a situational thing. What, you know, you have pets around, And as I had mentioned, I had run in cases in my career with no pets around, and it turned out it was a cat flea associated with a raccoon up in the chimney that was bothering the problem. So those can get kind of frustrating.
Yeah. Thank you, Carolyn. Appreciate the call. Moretta in McHenry, Illinois, it is your turn. Hi.
Okay. I have teeny tiny black ants that are crawling across my black counter, granite counter, which is underneath a window. Somebody told me they were sugar ants. I have tried all kinds of things to get rid of these things. Where are they coming from, and how do I get rid of them?
Okay. The easy thing, as an entomologist, we'd say, boy, we got to see what kind of ant and whatnot. But I'll give you kind of a quick and dirty trick. Ants either like sugar or they like fat and protein. And the problem with a lot of the baits that you buy are sugar-based with boric acid. And if you have a fat-loving ant, it could care less. And so what I often suggest to people is to put a little honey out in a piece of wax paper, put a little bit of cooking oil and see which of the two the ants want. Once you know that, whether you go to the hardware store or I'll tell you, it's better sometimes to go on the internet and order some of the baits that are specifically made for some of these grease-feeding ants. Now, my first guess is it's a thief ant, which is more of a fat-loving ant. But as we were talking about earlier in the program, seeing ants right now, the ground is way too cold. You know, insects being cold-blooded, if it is below 50 degrees where they're located, they cannot move. And because you're seeing ants now with the coolness outside, it suggests they're nesting either, underneath a slab or in a wall somewhere. The ideal thing is to find the nest and treat it, but some nests are very difficult to find. So then our next step is match the bait to whatever the ant wants. And the biggest mistake you can make is not keep giving them bait as long as they have an interest. The whole concept is they take it back and feed each other, and most importantly, they feed the queen, which is the reproductive member of the colony. And so they said why the sugar-based stuff might not work for you is they might not have any sugar taste or wants. And as they said, then you need to have basically a protein-based bait to control them.
There you go.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Miranda. Dave in Janesville, thank you for calling.
Yes, good morning. I've got a Polyphemus moth cocoon, something I don't see too many of anymore, along with a lot of other insects. But I would like to get her or him to hatch in spring along with other ones so I can let it go and let them mate.
So the only mistake you can make is you think it's doing them a favor by keeping indoors where it's warm, and it's not. Because typically most of these wild silkworms need a cold shock to develop correctly. Plus the other problem, even if they do get the cold shock, you leave them indoors, they come out in March, which is not the normal season. So what I often suggest is put out in the garage, put it out in a screened in porch, someplace that you can protect it from mice and other little vermin. Go through the normal chilling process in the winter, the normal warming up in the spring, and then I think you'll pretty much keep it on schedule. Would accept some time in the end of May or into June, when the adults will finally emerge for you. And boy, if you got neighbor kids or grandkids, those are fun things if they can ever observe once they come out. Because again, if you've not seen one of these things, a moth with 4-inch side wingspan and its body as big as a person's thumb is a pretty impressive critter.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I've got them in an unheated shed now.
Oh, that's perfect.
Yeah, it's perfect.
The one thing you might consider, I've had sometimes you have a little difficulty because things dry out a bit. And so what happens is when they emerge, the wings don't unfold properly. So it doesn't hurt once or twice a winter to go in there and just sprinkle a little bit of water, just to kind of get the humidity up. You don't want so much that things could get moldy when it warms up. But as I said, you're probably okay not doing that. But that's the one thing I often find would increase the probability that things would develop properly.
Okay. Well, appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. By the way, you can join in too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Have open lines, get you on pretty quickly. Matt in Hollandale, it's your turn. Hi, Matt.
Hello. I have what I believe is a cluster fly issue in our hunting cabin, mm-hmm. Which is unheated.
Yep.
But when we go during hunting season, we fire the wood stove up. The flies just seem to pour out of somewhere in droves.
Yep, it's classic. And they had a good year in this part of the state. Because I do some hunting over by Avoca, and I have not seen cluster fly populations like that out there in about 10 or 12 years.
It was insane. I was going through the large fly paper, the rollout like a paper towel, going through about 2 feet a night. It was insane.
Okay, so the best time to deal with it, and really the only time to deal with it, is in September.
Okay.
Because what's happening is they're crawling in cracks, crevices, openings, anything they can find. And naturally, they'll do this, you know, underneath tree bark and in seams of rocks on cliffs and whatnot. And then they spend the whole winter because it stays cold. And then when it warms up in the spring, they fly away. But the problem in the hunting cabin is when you warm it up, even it could be 2 weeks after they got in, they think it's spring, which, you know, seems not very smart on their part. So, you know, the best long-term solution is to tighten things up as much as you can. With some old hunting cabins, that's not possible. So the other possibility is you spray the outside, not the inside, probably the first week of September. And they're basically using the same kind of sprays we use in dairy barns to control flies. And what it will do is it'll kill them before they sneak in. But as I said, I would not let it go past the first or second week of September, because if it goes much later than that, there's probably some that have already snuck in. And then you can't get them. And so, you know, this time of the year, you know, you vacuum them up and the like, but it really isn't worth, you know, people like to set off bombs. And I think
I was wondering if there was a bomb or anything we could do.
Why they don't work. So the bomb kills everything that's in your living space, but the ones that are still in a wall are not touched. They don't penetrate anything.
Right.
And so you really don't gain much with them, unfortunately.
Okay. So basically preventative maintenance and maybe spraying in the fall.
Yeah. And,
second week of September.
Right. I mean, you can... you know, for large buildings, it's sometimes worth getting a professional come in because they've got the equipment for it. But, you know, for one stories most of the time. And if you're erring, you err around the soffits and high, not low, because typically the flies will crawl up and then get through whatever kind of seam or opening or even vents. Some vents are not screened properly, and, you know, critters the size of a fly have an easy time getting through it.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks very much for calling. On Facebook, Jade sent a note. I'm just wondering if that video on YouTube where a large spider is squashed and a million tiny spiders pop out of it, is that even possible?
Well, there's more going on there than it looks. So that is a classic. We talked earlier about the wolf spiders.
Yeah.
Well, since a wolf spider does not make a nest per se, you know, web to go in, they carry their babies on their back when they're small. And so you can see a case, if you weren't looking close enough and you crushed the spider, all the babies are leaving mom and stuff. And so it gives you the impression they were internal, but they're not. They're riding on the back. And as I said, same thing. You look on the internet and see some really neat pictures of wolf spiders carrying their offspring around. They don't do it for a very long time, but, you know, you can easily have 2-3 dozen little spiderlings on mom's back. So
there you go. And Jody on Facebook sent a nice photo of a cicada.
Yeah, and this, you can see the cast skin off to the right, and the color will change. The body will tend to get more of a really deep, dark green with black markings on it as it
tends
to mature.
Right now, it's kind of a lime color.
Yeah, and you know, we call critters that have just molted like that tenneral, and it's quite interesting. I used to laugh. I'd get maybe one or two cases a year where somebody would send me what they thought was an albino grasshopper or an albino cricket, and what they had is recently molted crickets or grasshoppers, and in the 2 days it took to get through the mail, they looked just like every grasshopper I've ever seen. But they said some beetles take upwards of a couple weeks to really get their full color, but that always tells you you've got something that's recently molted when they're kind of light colored like this and not the normal coloration you'd expect.
Cool picture. You can post one too on our Facebook page. I hope you'll do that. If you have a cool picture of an insect, or if you want one identified, we can take a crack at it, or at least Phil can. I won't know anything. That's on our Facebook page. The Larry Mueller Show is probably the place to go for that. Let's go to Lori in Burlington next. Hi, Lori.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I have a question about centipedes. I have, you know, everybody's got little spiders here and there, but I have centipedes in the house, and I know they like cold and damp, But it seems like, yes, in the wintertime, I get more in the basement. And I just, is there something that I can do to get rid of them?
Sure. There's two possible explanations. We do have outdoor centipedes in Wisconsin. You lift up a rock and the like and can see them. And once in a while, I see the outside types migrate inside. But that's kind of a seasonal thing. When people have reoccurring problems, there is a tropical centipede that has taken up residence in our homes and buildings in Wisconsin for decades. And they will breed continually. You don't see this kind outside. They have longer and creepier legs than our native centipedes. I mean, they're just unbelievable, scary looking things. But the problem with these things is, you know, they're wandering around in the walls and the attic and a bunch of places you can't get to very easily. So again, bombs and sprays to me don't get you where you need to go. As you had mentioned, they seem more common where it's kind of damp. So basements are more common. The more clutter you've got around, the more places they have to hide. So people talk about kind of keeping things open, trying to keep things airy would help. But I think a way, because they're relatively slow to breed, you know, it's not like you wake up one day and you got 1,000 of them. I mean, it's you know, kind of this constant trickle. Here's a case where, you know, these little sticky cardboard traps we call glue boards. You can put them back in corners. Now, you got to be careful you got pets because you don't want the cat to get in the glue board. But when a centipede goes across it, it gets caught. So it's a non-toxic, permanent way of removing critters from the population. And I think the combination of kind of getting things open a little bit and putting these glue boards back in some of these corners where they're running around will help reduce. I don't think you could ever eliminate them realistically without pulling the walls apart, and it's not worth that. But as I said, I think you can drastically reduce the numbers. And it's interesting. I probably see one centipede in my basement, maybe two a year. Yeah. And it's never worse than that. But as I said, I know the reality is no matter what I do, because there can be some in the walls and the like. And the other artifact is the more things that there are for them to eat, because they are predators, the better they do. So sometimes, you know, sealing the outside of the house so critters can't get in the fall helps reduce the amount of food for centipedes, and then you don't have as many.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck, Lori. Thank you very much for calling. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller, here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network as we take a look at the world of insects. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Phil Pelletieri, from the originally retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Great to have him back. And again, join in if you have a great photo. You can post it up on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can also email us a question at ideas@wpr.org or phone us at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to Facebook for a minute, because there's a really interesting photo of a wooden spoon. From Tracy. He says, I'm a woodworker, and sometimes I encounter these wormholes, as he calls them, in my wood pieces. What kind of insect makes them, and how can I prevent the damage from spreading both in the affected piece and to other pieces?
Sure. So the thing that I'm looking here, because on surface it looks the same, but there's a whole bunch of bark beetles, shot hole borers, natural insects you find in dead and dying trees. They will make holes and trails like this, but once they come out, which is usually within a number of months of the tree being cut and the wood starting to dry, they're done. Then you go to more seasoned wood, and there's a group of critters we call powder post beetles. Leave the same kind of holes. But the difference is that if a wood is actively infested with powder post beetle, you get this fine powder-like sawdust getting pushed out right in front of your eyes. They can reinfest the wood. But the success of powder post beetle depends on the moisture content of the wood. And so as it dries or as it's sealed and whatnot, it's no longer infested. So what I'm trying to sort through here, looking at that piece, was this old bark beetle damage? And, you know, bark beetles can continue to develop, even though the wood at first didn't look this way. But as I said, within the first few months, they emerge and they're done. Typical of bark beetles, when you cut the wood, the trails are tangential. You get all different size shape. typical of powder post beetle, they come out at a 90-degree angle to the surface of the wood, so you get this fine round hole. And as I said, so if the wood is sufficiently dry, you don't have any of these insects. I mean, that's why we kiln dry wood, is to basically shut all the insects down and, of course, to prevent warping. So I'm not overly concerned, other than, again, when you're a woodworker and you're working a piece of wood and you can see, even when you're not handling it, there's powder getting pushed out. That's powder post beetle. You can freeze it. You can heat it. You know, the ways of shutting it down. The other thing that's, once wood is processed, oiled, painted, whatever, if the powder post beetles aren't there yet, they can't get into it. They need open vessels. So it's usually more of a problem in, you know, rough sawed, you know, barn lumber, that kind of stuff. But where people get in trouble is when they store and air dry the lumber for 3 or 4 years out in a building. That's when the powder post beetles get access to it. That's when you bring it in and have the unfortunate case of noticing your wood's infested. What I warn people, though, is don't get too nervous here. You know, people think you can bring this wood in, my whole house is going to fall down because the critters will infest it. And here's one case that the benefit of our climate, we dry our wood out so much, and of course most of our wood is sealed, so I don't usually find a powder post beetle to be an aggressive problem in a heated building. In old cabins and whatnot where, you know, the moisture levels stay up, then they can be a problem, especially in crawl spaces. So, you know, you can look up stuff on powder post beetle, but as I said, this is just, I'm guessing, more old bark beetle damage. I don't see a lot of evidence of what, or any evidence of what I look at it as an active new powder post beetle infestation. Even if it was powder post, as I said, they can die out naturally if the wood is sufficiently dry. So.
And Tracy, I tell you what, there's a lot of character to that spoon.
Yeah, you know, some people pay extra money for wormy wood for reasons.
I kind of like it myself. Very cool. Well, Rusty in Marshall has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Rusty.
Hello, Larry. My question for Phil is, I think I've got powder post beetles.
Okay.
Oh.
I've got a cabin up north of Partyville, and I have these tiny little pinholes in the logs and a trail of sawdust outside.
Okay, but nothing inside?
No, they're inside and outside.
Okay. What I'm fishing for here is that it isn't uncommon in logs to have old bark beetle holes that, as we talked about, look very sufficient. On the outside, there are various little bees and other things that will utilize those holes as places to have nests. So you get the appearance that I've got wood borers and you don't.
Well, this is inside mostly.
Okay, then it could be powder post beetle. And so then we...
Yeah, they leave this trail of sawdust, and the sawdust shows up.
Right.
Now, and then if you look, you'll find where the hole is.
Is the inside of the cabin sealed, or is it just kind of a rough wood?
Just raw logs.
That's good. Not bad. That's good. Because the treatment they're using most of the time is a form of boric acid. One of the names it's sold under is Timbor, T-I-M-B-O-R. Another name is Boracare. There could be other products. But these are basically mixed with water. You spray or paint them on, and the borates soak into the wood. And if anything eats those borates, it will die. Now, it's not an immediate, they're dead tomorrow, but it's a way of basically insect-proofing against various wood-destroying insects. And you can have this commercially done for you, but you can also chase these products down. As I said, they're not that hard to deal with. You'd wait until the summer to put it on, and as I said, with a paintbrush or a sprayer. Sometimes they even talk about doing a double treatment. And then if you want to seal it afterwards, you can. You don't have to, but you can seal it. Where they don't work on the outside is that if you get a lot of water, they'll leach out.
Oh.
So you have to seal them in. But inside, that's not a problem.
There we go.
I see.
All right. Thanks, Rusty. Thank you very much for calling. Dick and Sister Bay, your turn. Hi, Dick.
Well, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was going to talk about, I don't know if it's called a phenomena, but a situation. I lived in the same home for 24 years. I've never seen this. I live up in Sister Bay, and I have a cement sidewalk out the front of my house. My granddaughters are often over, and this summer I went on the sidewalk to pick up what looked like a macrame bracelet or something like that. I reached down, and it was very small. They were very small, almost much smaller than rice. They had formed a circle, and within the circle there was a single what appeared to be a grub or a you know, some sort of a leader. And I removed them. The next day, there was another pile, again, forming this circle. And this went on for about 2 weeks in August. I was thinking it was September, but it was in August. And it was always the same appearance, always a single white grub. And I even put a couple of them under a microscope to look at them. They were very, very small. And I'm just wondering if you happen to know what I was dealing with.
Well, you know, except for the observation of a single white grub, you know, these kind of bands or clusters of insects, it reminds me of a group of fungus gnat maggots. And they often will migrate from one place to the next, and they're all kind of together. And they, as I said, it looks like a band. And then you look at that, there's multiple critters there. So I would say look at the internet and do fungus gnat maggots, and you should see some pictures to see if that fits.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing I could think of, so, you know, when insects get parasites in them, when the insect's dying, the parasites come out. But I wouldn't expect them to be kind of in that circular. And it's really quite unusual to find multiple insects in, you know, on a daily basis with parasites in them like that. So I, you know, that.
They would always move as a group. It would be interesting because I would see it and it would be on the other side of the sidewalk.
Yeah, that's the classic of fungus gnats. You know, as they said, fungus gnat larvae, and you might even put, you know, clusters of fungus gnats. It's really maggots, and they've got little dark heads and clear bodies, and they're not very big. And typically, they feed in organic matter. So usually, you know, got mulch and other kinds of things. And then you see these groups migrating through, and they're really kind of spooky looking, especially when you find out there's...
It's very bizarre.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, Nick.
Sure.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Well, let's go to Cheryl in Wauwatosa next. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling to kind of settle an ongoing argument with my husband, and it involves spiders that come into your house. For whatever reason, I've always liked spiders. I don't want to kill them. I think it goes back to me reading Charlotte's Web when I was a kid. Yeah. I've always been a big spider fan. And so when they come into my house, especially in winter, I just kind of let them be. They live in their little corners or whatever. My husband is convinced that they come and they bite him in the night.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if this is really true. Like, if you leave a spider in your house, is it going to come and bite you during the night, or right. Can I just let them be?
Generally not. And what we find is over 90% of what people present as spider bites are not. Now, if you pick up a spider and start handling it, could they bite you? Yes. But they definitely don't go out of their way. So if people get reoccurring bites, we're looking for other things. It's not typical of spider. Many of our spiders don't even have the right type of fangs that could penetrate our skin. You know, they can't get the leverage, or they're not sharp enough and the like. So as I said, boy, they get blamed for a whole lot that they're not responsible for.
Well, and in as a matter of fact, it's not like he's getting bites. He's just afraid he's going to get
bites. Yeah, no. And, you know, and the other classic one, although things have gotten better in the last few years, is there is a spider called a brown recluse that, you know, where people that get bit by it in areas where it's typically found, which is south of us, they get these incredibly nasty ulcerations and problems. But what has been found is a lot of cases people thought they had recluse bite. It turned out it was just a staph infection. So it was really nothing to do with spiders at all. And so, as I said, but there's a whole bunch of stuff on the internet that is just absolutely, you know, mind-numbing how scary it looks. But as I said, what we find out is most of the cases, even people who think they had recluse, turned out it was not. I know of a number of cases in my career where we kind of, you know, could walk things through. In what first was presented as a recluse, it turned out not to be. And so, yeah, nothing I can find in this state I worry about. We do have black widows in the state. They're few and far between. And the interesting thing, even though I would see widows come in the lab on occasion, I never in my 36 years in the lab met anybody, knew of any case where there was a confirmed black widow bite in Wisconsin.
Well, thank you very much. I can continue to let them be and not kill them. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Cheryl.
Husband's not going to be happy with me, I can tell. But
Adrian in Menominee Falls, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Great, appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
Well, I have this reoccurring issue during the summer months. Our home is kind of built into a hillside, and our garage is exposed. And it seems like almost every night we have hundreds of centipedes that come into the garage, and by the next morning they're dead on the edges of the wall.
Yep.
And I didn't know what's causing it. I mean, they don't really do any damage.
Yeah, no, they're not centipedes, they're millipedes. And you know, the difference is millipedes feed on organic matter and are found in much bigger numbers. Centipedes are predators. You never find bushel baskets full of them. But what's going on is millipedes at night migrate. And when the sun comes up, they accumulate where it's cool, damp, and dark. And so a cement slab in a garage is like a magnet.
Hmm.
And the problem is people often will respond to this by spraying the garage floor. Well, they're not coming from the garage floor. In fact, we know they can migrate from big distances. And my old friend, Stan Temple, tells the story of he was watching them in his backyard. And I think he figured that one centipede could go 100 yards, excuse me, millipede could go 100 yards in like about 3.5 minutes. So, you know, the problem in a case like yours is where all the leaf litter and other things out in the forest and areas around you is where these things are breeding. And then they migrate in, as I said, at night and then accumulate there. And, you know, they don't hurt anything other than the problem. But the numbers can be staggering. We had a person that called in on the show years ago. He used to tell us about he could fill a 5-gallon bucket daily on the dead ones that were in next to his driveway in a drainage ditch, migrating from a field next to him.
There we go. Thanks, Adrian, for calling. Appreciate it. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today. We are going to take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us, and then we will be back with Phil, and he'll be with us to 12:30. Stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network as we take a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at the UW-Madison. Great to have him along. Thanks for listening. Join in at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or go ahead and post photos on our Facebook page. Love to hear from you. And we'll get to some of those photos in a minute. But first, John in Shell Lake, it's your turn. Hi, John.
Hi there. How are you guys doing?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Hey, I got about a 3-year-old garage I built. And in between the apron in front of the garage and the garage floor itself in the summertime, I'll get these little about 1-inch long worms that are, I mean, they're always curled up almost in the like the letter C shape.
Yep.
And they come up out of there by the thousands. I mean, they'll make a big mound of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've poured gas on them. I've sprayed them with anything I can think of.
Sure.
And it just doesn't, I mean, it's just crazy how many of them come up out of there.
Right. But, you know, much like the person we were talking to just before the break, they're millipedes and they're not breeding there. They're collecting there is the better way to think of it. And, you know, I'm sure it's a little bit moist there.
Yeah.
And as I said, they're crawling around at night. And then when the sun comes up, they're accumulating where it's kind of cool and damp and sometimes dark. And if there's any kind of space underneath the slab, I can see that, you know, who knows how many could squeeze into there. And, you know, whatever you do treat could kill what's there now, but more come. And so it may be worth looking at some kind of modification. Now, I know they sell a type of sand at some of the, you know, Home Depots and whatnot that you use when you're, you know, you're doing brickwork. But the thing about this sand is that you put it down and it kind of solidifies as a layer, you know, on the top. So it's kind of impenetrable. We use this to keep ants out of sandy areas because the ants can't get through the stuff. And I wonder if that would crust enough. And then, of course, being sand, being drier, it would not be a place where millipedes want to hang out. You know, and so what I'm suggesting is to go a direction to change the environment so millipedes don't want to hang out there. Because as I said, the frustration for you is they could be migrating in from 300-400 yards or more away. It's just every day, you know, it's just like a beacon. This is a place that we can hang out. And as I said, you kill everything that's there today, but you never really get at the breeding site. And, you know, I tease people about this, but, you know, it gets real frustrating in some rural areas because the numbers are so staggering. I said, well, if you make your whole yard a sandbox, you wouldn't have them because there's no organic matter. It's too dry. You know, that's not realistic. But as I said, in this case, anything you can do to get better drainage, get better drying, and I would play around with sand types. And as I said, if you can get this one to kind of crust over a bit, I mean, the other possibility, I don't know how big a space this is there some kind of rubber barrier or caulking you can put in, you know, to keep them out of there. But I would go more that physical direction than spraying.
There you go. Good luck. And what's the name of that sand again that you...
I don't even know what the technical name is, because it's interesting because, as I said, it keeps the ants out, but yet if you've got to change it, it's not like it's cement and it's hard to break through, but it's a poly sand of some sort.
Oh.
And what it is there's a plastic resin, I think, mixed with it.
Thanks, John. Jason in Wauwatosa, your turn. Hi, Jason.
Hey, guys. How's it going? Thanks for taking my question.
Sure thing.
I have a question. So starting a couple of years ago, we noticed those black carpenter bees kind of flying around. And as I've read, the males that don't sting are kind of social, and you'll see them flying over your head and everything. And we didn't think too much of it. And then kind of redoing our siding on our house, this past year I've realized that they've burrowed pretty well, multiple holes, probably 20 holes below a gutter. Above our porch. So I've been reading about it, and it seems like the best way is to powder the hole so that the carpenter bees in the spring will bring it in and poison all the larva that's inside. The only problem with that is we have woodpeckers that, I don't particularly want the woodpeckers pecking on that part of the house either, but they go after the larva, and I'm assuming that poison, if we put it out for the carpenter bees, is probably not going to be that good for the woodpeckers. So I didn't know if there's a way to do that. They say that just covering it up with caulk means that they'll burrow further and maybe find another way out. So just looking for advice.
Yeah, well, typically, they like to get in softened or seasoned wood. And so sometimes, painting and the like. But I think you do have some powder options, only in that the two powders I could think that are readily available would be toxic to the bees, but not so much, if at all, to the woodpeckers. It turns out that the two products you would get are either Carbaryl, or it's sometimes called Seven Dust. And, we used to put Seven Dust on chickens to get rid of mites and the like. The other one are the pyrethroids, in particular permethrin, again, is a product that's registered for birds to get rid of lice and the like. And so those powders are not the kind of problems like some of the older pesticides that would be highly toxic to the birds. But... the problem is fine. You can dust the nests, kill the critters. But I unfortunately think this is going to be an annual problem unless you make some more of a physical adjustment in that area.
I was planning on covering, it's an older house, 120 years old. So I was planning on putting a metal covering over that fascia board when I replaced the gutter. I just didn't want to do it with the bees still in there.
Sure.
I read about them, finding another way out, which they easily can in our, with rotted wood in our house. So
yeah.
It's a powder, and then covering it up would be a solution, and that sounds great to me.
Right.
All right. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Quick look to Facebook here, and Paul sent us a photo of a wolf spider with an egg case from Western Samoa.
Well, in our world, spiders do the same thing. I mean, it's just mind-boggling. It's like a big marble they're carrying around. And as I said, even when the little guys hatch, they kind of hang out with mom for a while. And so that's a neat picture.
Really cool photo. I like that. Thank you for sending it, Paul. Lisa in Janesville has something for us. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Larry. A few years ago, I must have been maybe 4 or 5, all throughout the state of Wisconsin, I was seeing these really cool moths. They were hummingbird moths.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And, they were flying all around. I have not seen one since then. How do we get to encourage them to come back?
Well, it turns out we probably have, I'm guessing, 25 species of hawk moth, sphinx moth, or hummingbird moth. They're kind of an interchangeable use. Most of them are most active at night. There is one species that I'm aware of, the white-line sphinx, that about every 7 or 8 years we get this huge outbreak, and they're everywhere. And I bet you that's what you experienced. And they are more day flyers.
Right.
But it's a weird insect because it has a very broad range of plants, including weeds like plantain and whatnot, that it feeds on. And I don't know what the dynamic of why you get population explosion some years and not. But I think they just go through natural cycles. And as I said, there are a lot more hawk moth species that people are aware of. It's just that you got to be out at night at 10 o'clock and, collecting moths to see them, because they're just, most of them aren't active during the day. But the white-line sphinx is. And usually late summer is the, when we see a lot of them. And, I can tell we're having an outbreak when, somebody says, I see 3 or 4 in my garden, one afternoon. That's... those are high numbers, and that's not normal. But as I said, you will see cycles in years that we do see it.
There you go.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Pete in Reedsburg emailed to ask if it's true that the colder the winter, the bigger the Japanese beetle grub die-off. If so, how cold does it need to get and for how long to give us some reprieve from Japanese beetles?
Yeah. You know, that was a theory that I, when Japanese beetles were first coming, our first records were in the 60s in the state, and then they died out, and we thought it was our blessed Wisconsin winter. Well, when they really started to take hold in the late 1990s, I saw them survive 30 below down in Janesville, and then I knew the game was over. It just doesn't get cold enough. Now, milder winter is a little better survival, but I have no faith anymore that it will ever get cold enough to get rid of Japanese beetles. And I think the dynamic, two dynamics, is one, in a lot of areas, when they first get in there, they're most damaging for like 8 to 10 years, and then they get better. That's the way it is on the west side of Madison, where I live, and we have 10% of the population we had during the outbreak in the early 2000s and the like. The other dynamic is, you know, the milder the winter, you expect the better survival, but I think moisture levels have more to do with it. If we have dry late summers, they have a lot of problems getting those grubs through. Now, unfortunately, on golf courses in highly irrigated lawns, it's never droughty, and so there are always places they will survive. On the other hand, when you get lush years and then a mild winter in combination, that's unfortunately when I expect the next year we pay for it with more Japanese beetles.
Mark and Stoughton, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. This summer, I was letting the dog out at night next to the house, and I saw three, what looked like worms, glowing in the dark. And they kind of lingered there for a few weeks, actually. Mm-hmm. One of them slowly migrated away. I was just wondering what they might be. They're about an inch and a half long, and they glow in the dark.
Sure. So there is legally and officially something called a glowworm, and it is the first cousin of a firefly. Now, fireflies are one family of beetles. The phengotids, or glowworms, are a second family of beetles. And the difference is the phengotids don't glow as adults. They glow as larvae. And they don't flash. They glow, as you say. Mm-hmm. And they're like a mood ring. If you disturb them in a period of about 2 or 3 minutes, they stop glowing. When they're happy again, they glow back. And so it's usually you find them in kind of moist areas under bushes. They're predators. And honestly, predators of millipedes, among other things. The millipedes that we're talking about messing with people, well, these things eat millipedes. So that's good.
Okay.
Kind of fun critters. And there are some species, it's a very interesting family of beetles. There are some species that the female never becomes a true adult. It mates as a, quote, larva. It's really an adult. The other thing is the males are the most bizarre-looking insects with big feathery antennae. They look nothing like a beetle. When we wanted to be mean during some of our master's exams, we would bring a phengotid male in and ask the student to identify it. And as I said, if you had not seen it before, yeah, it really was not fair. I would never do anything like that, of course, but we did know, we used to tease about that. So it's a fun family to look up, and you know, you may see them there again next year, you may not. They kind of ebb and flow. It's not an outrageously common insect. So you know, you're kind of fortunate when you see them, but that's, I'm sure, what's going on. And as I said, look up glowworm, and you will see the true phengotids. But it is a family of beetles, and it's the same light mechanism as fireflies. They just don't flash like fireflies.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Speaking of photos here, Jim sent us a photo. Can you identify this small flying insect our family call fairy bugs?
Sure.
White.
So technically it's a type of woolly aphid, and woolly aphids secrete this kind of fibrous material around the abdomen. And if I had to take a guess, the most common one we see is called the woolly alder aphid, and it jumps between alder and maple, and you get certain flights in the middle of July or whatnot, and there's these white little puffballs flying around, and you catch one, and that's what you see. So it's definitely a woolly aphid, and if I had to guess, the woolly alder aphid is the type of species, but there are multiple ones, and kind of fun to see. And you can scrape that stuff off. It's insect's version of cotton candy, really, if you want to get down to it. Although there's a little bit more protein or fat to it, but it's a neat group of critters. Again, the critter underneath that is much smaller. I mean, it looks like a little gnat, but technically it's an adult winged aphid.
Derek in Duluth, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Derek.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a follow-up question for the powder post beetle. Mm-hmm. we have a similar issue with our cabin in northern Minnesota, except it's on the hardwood floors, which is treated. So I was just wondering, what do you do then? Is there anything you can do about that?
Yeah, the problem there is the borates will not penetrate into the wood unless you sand it. And the other thing you can do, but this is we're a long-term thing. So as we were talking about, it's typically not much of a problem. You get it in new flooring sometimes, you know, that the wood's infested and you seal it up and there you replace a couple boards and that's about it. But if it's a cabin, one of the reasons they're maintaining themselves is you're not drying the wood out like you would if it was a year-round home.
Mm.
And that's better. So anything you do to reduce the moisture, so I don't know if there's a crawl space there or something similar, but you know, anything you do to aerate, as I said, to lessen the amount of available moisture, that will help in the long run. But unfortunately, I think if it you know, it seems to still be quite active, the solution is to sand the floor, treat it with the borates, and then you can reseal it.
Is if you just let it go, how much construction can they eventually ruin your cabin?
It's variable even within a board because the starch and moisture content will vary. So you'll see one corner of a flooring board that is just riddled, and you see the other end of it, and they're not messing with it. And again, in the long run, anything you can do to lessen the moisture makes the conditions less suitable in all the wood.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for answering my question. Have a great day.
Yeah, you as well. Thank you so much. Chris in Watertown, your turn. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Larry. I love your bug shows.
Oh, thank you.
I have an invasion of tiny, tiny brown spiders, and I've been told through my life that centipedes eat other critters, little insects, rather. Yes. Could I bring in a predatory centipede or some other insect to eat brown spiders or whatever? Is that stupid rationale?
Yeah, no. I mean, they got to eat something, and if there's spiders there, that's just as viable a prey as anything else. The problem is finding somebody that's going to lend you these, what I call house centipedes. The, you know, Centroides is the genus. As I said, you typically, you know, when you once you have them, you kind of always have them. Because even if you move, typically you're moving boxes that have centipedes in them. And so, as I said, it's more, unfortunately, a problem that some people go the other way. Of course, they don't want the centipedes. But if you can get some of these house centipedes established, they will hunt every night and looking for something to eat. And if those spiders are in the way, they will take care of them.
Yay!
There you go.
So you're going to have to ask your friends if they can catch you a centipede for you, you know, to bring over. So
how do you multiply them?
Well, they'll do well on their own. You know, it's an artifact of how much they got to eat, you know. But, I don't know of any commercial. The only commercial centipedes I know available are the big, scary tropical ones that, you know, they put in insect zoos. But, the interesting thing about the Centroides, I mean, way back, it used to be called the Mexican's house centipede. And what they were referring to is it was more common in outdoors in climates like Mexico and southern Texas. As I said, now I just often see it referred to as a house centipede, and it definitely is not native outdoors in Wisconsin. It's only found indoors.
There you go. Thank you, Chris. Appreciate the call. And Christine in Franklin. Let's go to you now. Hi, Christine.
Hi. I had yellow jackets that were between my patio and the house foundation last year.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I sprayed two cans of spray at them in the hole, and it didn't kill them.
Sure.
And then I got them as they were coming out, actually. And but this year, I had near under my basement floor, near the water drain, I kept having a lot of dead yellow jackets there, mm-hmm. and they were coming up, I think, through my vent. I have insulation between my wall, my outside wall, up in the rafter, like.
Mm-hmm.
Could they have built a nest somewhere?
Well, you know, it could very likely, it's the same kind of yellow jackets you experienced both times. Basically, yellow jackets are a paper wasp, and there is a bunch of them, or at least a handful of species, that will nest in the ground or in a void. So if they can get up underneath your siding, and you know you've got pockets in your between your walls that are a void space, and oftentimes when we have those kind of nests, they get mixed up and then they kind of filter into the house, whether they come down through a light fixture or through your sill plates and the like. Now the good news is they're all dead, and they will not come back to the same nest typically. But if you've got conditions that they can find next spring, a queen can start everything over again. So, you know, around the foundation, you've got any kind of pockets, gopher holes, washed out areas, just fill those in by, I would say, the first week of June. And because they're not really efficient diggers by themselves, they need to start with a hole. They can make it a little bigger when the nest gets going. Now, the nests that are up in a wall, you have to kind of watch. If you've got any kind of openings, you caulk, seal, plug, that will work. The other thing I'll suggest to you is if you ever get unfortunate enough to have a problem again, if you cannot see the nest, so it's going in a wall, in a hole, or is it going in the ground, don't use a spray, use a dust. We find that sprays just don't get to where it needs to. The dust, although it doesn't work as instantly as a spray, when they come and go, they get it on their body. So I've had much better success with treating these ground or void nests with dust when we have to. Now, the problem sometimes when they get up in a wall, the only way you can get the dust there is have a squeezed mustard bottle or a turkey baster or something to blow the dust up in there. But I think on the preventative side is you look for these openings that they can get access to. As long as you've got those dealt with by even the 1st of July, you're okay. It's when we get in the late summer when the nests have been successful that we have problems. And as I said, the good news about it is that no matter where they're located, they cannot survive. They do not have any food. There's no way. I don't care how warm the winter is. They cannot survive our winters, except for the fertilized queens that come out next spring, and they start everything from scratch. But if you've got enough environments around the house, it's not unusual to have a nest somewhere on the property every year.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. And Lynn in Evansville. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call. So I have a quick question. It's an odd question in that I've been infested with mosquitoes. I only have standing water in my pet water bowl and my bathroom. Where are they coming from?
So typically, I don't expect mosquitoes to breed indoors. But we do have a group of mosquitoes, the genus Culex, which overwinters as adults in a cave or, you know, similar environments. And so what you find on occasion is that they will migrate into the basement and they're going to try to spend the winter there as adults. But then, you know, people bump into them or whatnot. So, you know, people would call me up and they were getting mosquito bites in January and they never left the house. Yes, it is possible. What that would suggest to me, though, is if that many gets into your basement, they're getting easy access. I mean, that's not typical. That's kind of atypical. And it would be more common in an older, damp basement than normal. So kind of hunt around and see. I think if you can seal them off, keep them out of the basement to begin with, you don't have the problem. But as I said, very unlikely that you've got mosquitoes breeding inside your house in Wisconsin.
Thank you very much for calling, Lynn. And Phil, thank you. We'll look forward to your next visit. You're going to be back February 15th, day
Sounds
after
good.
Valentine's. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty, associate emeritus at the UW-Madison. Always great to have him along, and he'll be back February 15th. Tomorrow at this time, Tom Wilmoth, our favorite pop music expert, will talk about holiday music, both old and new. And then we'll get our annual Christmas visit from bread maker Paul Novak. He's going to be talking about pies, pastry, and even pizza crust. In the meantime, stay with us.